This is the Leonard Lopate Show at WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in for Leonard Lopate. The recent coverage of Hurricanes Harvey and Irma saw the return of two staples of weather reporting. Wet TV correspondents standing in the rain being blown around yelling out their updates, and the resurgence of phrases like bunker down and ride out the storm. Returning to the show to help us understand why some terms crop up during natural disasters is Wall Street Journal language columnist Ben Zimmer. Ben, welcome back. It's a reunion for us. And I want to open this up to all of you listening. If you have questions about how we describe hurricanes or storms, give us a call. Give us a call at 212-433-9692. So, Ben, are there any other terms that you see a lot when big storms approach? I talked about ride out the storm, bunker down or hunker down, shelter in place.
I mean, every time there's a big hurricane like this, there are certain words and phrases that just pop up with great frequency. And so, obviously, we hear about people, whether it's with Harvey in Texas or with Irma in Florida, how people are evacuating or whether they're going to stay there. And so, yeah, we constantly hear, for instance, hunker down. Or they're just going to hunker down. As you mentioned, bunker down is a kind of a more recent variation on that theme.
It's odd, bunker down.
Yeah, it sort of combines.
From?
Well, I mean, hunker down originally comes from a Scottish word hunker, which means to kind of crouch down low and squat like on the balls of your feet. That's hunkering. So you're basically as low to the ground as you can get, but you're also sort of ready to move if you need to.
Mm-hmm.
So that's hunkering. And then sort of the idea of hunkering down, that entered American English around the turn of the 20th century. And it started getting these sort of more figurative meanings. So it could be to just kind of like focus on the task at hand. We just have to hunker down, sort of like buckle down. But then it also had this meaning of kind of taking shelter. We just have to hunker down. So that's been, in American English for about a century. And more recently, it's gotten kind of combined with the word bunker, which is not related etymologically, although it also comes from a Scottish source. And so, the idea of the image of the bunker as something sort of below ground where you might actually seek refuge kind of combines well with hunkering down.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we start hearing people talking about bunkering down. It's actually very common in Australian English to say that, and now increasingly common in American English.
I'm not a fan of bunker down. It's weird. It sounds like an oral typo.
Well, it does seem a little weird. Yeah. I think you'll be hearing it more and more. And, there's a whole sort of set of terms. So you hear people talking about riding out the storm, for instance.
And where does that come from? Is that a Navy? From the Navy?
Yeah, exactly. It's a nautical term going back centuries. So if you were on a ship and you had to get through that storm, you would ride it out. And so then that got kind of translated to people on land who were, riding out the storm. Even though they're not obviously, not moving in the same way you would be on a ship. And then a kind of a more official term for, staying put during a storm is sheltering in place. So we hear that sometimes very often in like official advisories, like telling people don't move, just shelter in place. And that goes back actually to the 1970s. I found examples from back then where it was sort of, Cold War scenarios of nuclear fallout. And so there were congressional hearings on civil defense where they were talking about, sheltering in place as something you would do in the case of, a nuclear
annihilation, yeah, which exactly. Sheltering in place is just get the right. Bottle of bourbon and just call it a day because you're not going to survive.
Right.
You said something a moment ago, about these advisories from officials. We got to talk about the National Weather Service.
Mm-hmm.
And with Harvey, they sent out a tweet, not Harvey, Irma,
yeah.
That was like visually alarmist. It had multiple asterisks. It had all caps
right. Saying,
"This is as real as it gets. Nowhere in the Florida Keys will be safe. You still have time to evacuate."
Yeah.
Didn't they say before Irma that they were no longer going to be sending out advisories like that?
Well, except in special cases. I think they made a decision actually last year, I think it was, that they would stop doing these sort of screaming all caps messages. unless it was a true emergency. So the idea is like, you know, hold back. Otherwise, people won't take it seriously when you really are kind of screaming at them in all caps. National Hurricane Center must have decided that this is one of those cases. If you were in the Florida Keys, you better get out of there. And you know, this is sort of the strongest language that they could possibly mm-hmm. use to convey that message.
So those are authorities, federal authorities, local authorities, weather authorities. But then you've got meteorologists, the mm-hmm. folks on television. Have they changed how they describe the severity of a storm? Are they overhyping storms, or are they trying to stay in line with the National Weather Service in how they describe oncoming storms?
Well, it's tricky. I mean, are they overhyping it? I mean, to some extent, you know, you have the 24-hour news channels like CNN that, you know, are sort of constantly bombarding you with this. But at the same time, I mean, these hurricanes, Harvey and Irma, they were extremely serious. And so using sort of more hyperbolic language might have actually been, you know, appropriate in these cases. I know that Irma was not necessarily as bad as some feared it might be in Florida, but, you know, it's sort of like dodging a bullet, I guess. It could have been much worse. And so in the same way that the officials from the National Weather Center are trying to get these messages across, I think that meteorologists on television, whether it's the Weather Channel or the news channels, are, you know, sometimes needing to put things in as stark terms as possible. If people are, you know, watching in advance of a storm, they need to know to take it seriously. There is a danger, of course, though, if the language is always kind of hyperbolic, people just get inured to that, and they may not sort of appreciate the seriousness of it.
Yeah, I remember there was a few years back with some of the either hurricanes or snowstorms, like you're hunkering down, right, waiting for the feet of snow to right. pile up, and then you wake up the next morning and yeah. there's nothing, like all that hype for no reason. Ben, we have a call. We've got Jan in the East Village who has a question. Jan.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I was wondering about the expression "a perfect storm." I know there was a movie with that title,
it's a
but
really
I don't
movie.
Know if the expression already existed and they just used that for the title of the movie, or they made it up for the movie and now it has a sort of general metaphorical usage. You know, it was a perfect storm. You know, the president and the Congress, whatever. So I'll take the answer off the radio. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Jane. That is a good question. I mean, that was a good movie. I think that was George Clooney and some other folks trying to ride out a storm.
Right, exactly.
But a huge cataclysmic storm. Don't want to give it away for anyone who hasn't seen it. But there's a scene when there's a giant wave and that book gets tossed around. Where does that that phrase come from, the perfect storm?
Well, I mean, it actually goes back pretty far. I mean, there are examples of that phrase, a perfect storm, going all the way back to the late 18th century, I believe. And it really does start off as this kind of a meteorological term to describe this kind of confluence of events. It's not just a powerful hurricane necessarily, but it's sort of this combination of different meteorological conditions that lead to a perfect storm. And so that was one that, you know, that the sailors who were, or the, you know, the people that were depicted in the movie and the book that it was based on would have been familiar with, and certainly the movie in particular helped to popularize that. And then again, yeah, you have this kind of figurative extension of meaning, where a perfect storm is just, you know, there's a convergence of different factors all coming together at once to cause a really bad situation. That predates the movie, though. There are examples of that more figurative use going back to the 19th century, but certainly once the movie came out, that became just a very popular sort of part mm-hmm. of the language.
You know, speaking of storms, there are two terms that I'm wondering if they are scientific, or it's just meteorologists and journalists yeah. like coming up with some fancy name. Eyewall
yeah.
and storm surge.
Right. Well, those are definitely both technical terms. I mean, but it's funny, we all kind of become amateur meteorologists when hurricanes happen, and you know we're seeing this round the clock coverage, and we all you know sort of learn these terms that otherwise would just be you know meteorologists saying, oh, where's the eye wall on this storm? And so yeah, I mean an eye wall, you know, quite literally describes the where the eye of the hurricane is, where the sort of the ring around that eye. And so as the eye wall approaches, and we saw on CNN, for instance, you know, people who are sort of in the middle of the storm in Naples, Florida or whatever, being told the eye wall is coming. And then once they're in the eye, it calms down, and then the winds will turn around and blow the other way and cause even more damage. So, and same with storm surge. I mean, these are terms that normally, again, would just sort of appear in, you know, weather advisories. But because we're paying such close attention to these major storms, we kind of incorporate this language and sort of learn how to use them, too.
And the winds become stronger as you get closer. It's more dangerous the closer you are to the eye wall.
Yeah, I think that, again, I'm not a meteorologist, but I believe that's how it works.
It seemed to be that
you know, as the eye wall approaches, then you get, you know, bigger and bigger storms moving in one direction, then the eye may pass over you if you're right in the middle, and then you get the eye wall on the other side blowing wind in the other direction, and that's what can cause like lots of trees to fall because they've been, you know, blowing in two different directions.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in for Leonard Lopate, speaking with Ben Zimmer about, well, the language of natural disasters. And if you have a questions about how we describe hurricanes or storms, or just the words that you hear and you want to know where do they come from, Ben is the guy to ask. And you can ask him by calling 212-433-9692. And in fact, we have Michael on the line who has a question. Michael.
Hi. How you doing?
Great.
Good. I wasn't sure if you were talking to me yet.
Yeah. Totally talking to you. What's your question, Michael?
Cool. This is not about a storm. It is about a natural disaster. Whenever the spoken media refers to an earthquake, the first time they talk about it, they say there's been an earthquake. And the second time they refer to it, they always use a different word. They always use temblor. Is there some kind of stylistic rule in the media never to repeat the word earthquake? Is that just a clumsy way to say it? It drives me batty. I can predict it instantly.
Well, as a scribbler, I can tell you that it's the whole thing of not using the same word twice, especially in a sentence or a paragraph. That's whether it's with regard to earthquakes or to anything. But I'll let Ben talk to the issue of temblor.
Yeah. Again, that's sort of a technical term that, you know, seismologists use or whatever, but there really is no distinction, as far as I know, between, you know, calling it an earthquake or a temblor. And I wonder too sometimes when that term gets used in reports whether it's really perhaps reporters wanting to sound like they're very knowledgeable, and so they're using this, what sounds like a more technical term to them, rather than simply using the word earthquake. Temblor comes from a Spanish root, literally means trembling, it's basically synonymous with earthquake. So if you hear temblor, you can safely just translate that in your head as earthquake.
Yeah, or in Italian, it's terremoto. But this is not an Italian lesson. Hey, can we talk about how hurricanes are named? But before it, I seem to recall they were always named after, as long as I've been alive. First, they were named after women, and then they decided to alternate male female storm names. What is this about? How did this all start? Help me, Ben.
Yeah, it's
to understand this.
Well, the U.S. National Hurricane Center actually started naming storms that develop in the Atlantic back in the 1950s, and now it's the World Meteorological Organization that's in charge of naming hurricanes and other big storms.
Some big international body, based in Zurich.
I'm not sure where they're based, but they're in charge. And so actually, they're like member states, and they all actually now sort of contribute to the list of names that they use. But you're right that it started off just being women's names and didn't actually change until, I believe, 1979 was when and they decided, maybe that might be a little sexist just to be using women's names for these storms. And so now we have the system where you alternate between female and male names. And now what you have is there's a list of they have six lists. So it basically covers 6 years, and then they cycle back around. So the list that that is being used this year is actually the same list of names that was used 6 years ago in 2011. They keep reusing names unless there's a really big one, like, say, Harvey or Irma, and then that has to be retired. That's sort of taken out of rotation.
Because it's so deadly or so damaging.
Yeah. There will never be another Hurricane Katrina or Sandy or Harvey or Irma. And in fact, 6 years ago, you might remember there was a Hurricane Irene in 2011.
Oh, yeah.
And so Irene was retired in 2011. And so Irma was the replacement for Irene. And that's why we have Irma this time around. They've actually been running through a lot of those I names. I believe Irma is going to be like the 11th name beginning with I that they have to retire. So I'm worried that they might start, you know, running out of names beginning with I.
So, you know, do you know about this study from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, where they found that storms with the most feminine names were an estimated 5 times more deadly than those with masculine names? To me, that sounds like a make-work project. Like, what is that about?
Yeah, well, there was a study. It came out a few years ago in 2014, and it got a fair amount of attention at the time. And yeah, it kind of made this conclusion based on what is really a pretty small sample size of hurricanes. And, you know, again, they've been named since the 50s, but for a couple of decades there were just female names. And so the study that was made that seemed to find a correlation between storms with women's names, especially ones that are perceived as being particularly feminine, and higher death tolls for these hurricanes. This study came out and it tried to make the conclusion that perhaps people aren't taking storms as seriously if they have these female names, especially the more feminine ones. But there was a lot of critique at the time of this study. Again, a small sample size. Those early storms from, you know, the 50s, 60s, 70s were just female names anyway, and they may have been stronger for other reasons. And, you know, they found that, like, if you had just taken out Hurricane Sandy, which was a female-named storm at the time, if you just removed that one, then it kind of switched the other way that, you know, that the male storms, you could say, were more deadly than the female ones. So the problem is, small sample size, you can't really make any judgment on it. So, you know, that study was hotly disputed, let's say.
I would say problematic.
Yes, exactly.
I'm Jonathan Capehart in today for Leonard Lopate, and my guest is Ben Zimmer, Wall Street Journal language columnist. We're talking about the words and phrases we use during natural disasters and how that can influence the way we feel about them. We're going to talk about snow when we come back. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We'll be right back after a break. Oh, Ben, we're back. I'm Jonathan Capehart in today for Leonard Lopate. This is the Leonard Lopate Show on WNYC and WNYC.org. Ben Zimmer is a language columnist for the Wall Street Journal, and we're talking about the language of natural disasters. Before the break, we were talking about hurricanes and sort of the how we talk about them, hunkering down, bunkering down, riding out the storm. We had a question about where does the phrase perfect storm comes from. We had someone call in, Ben, who couldn't hang on the line, but they wondered where the term polar vortex came from. This was something I hadn't heard of it until maybe, what, 2 winters ago, where all of a sudden the polar vortex is going to come down and temperatures are going to plummet into the teens and we're going to stay there for days and days on end, which is not a problem for me because you just put on a hat and a nice cashmere scarf and you're set. But where did this come from, this term? Technical or something my brethren, our fellow journalists came up with?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Actually, the first example of that term, polar vortex, was way back in 1853, believe it or not. But yeah, it describes the situation that you have where, you know, there's this low pressure system over the North Pole, over the Arctic region, and then it brings down all of this cold air through Canada and down to us. And so it got a lot of attention the winter of 2013, 2014. And suddenly it seemed like everywhere in the news media and, you know, Weather Channel and everything, it's the polar vortex, it's coming. That's a nice example of a technical term that was sort of lurking around for a while. And then, folks in the news media or the Weather Channel kind of glommed onto it. And suddenly it seemed like it was everywhere.
Well, I mean, it is vivid. When I hear polar vortex, I know, bring out the big coat, the gloves, the hat, the scarves, all the sweaters, because it's going to be cold.
Okay, well, then it's doing its job, you know.
That's the whole right. point. You know, one of the things I wanted to talk, I brought up polar vortex because I wanted to talk about snow. And we are always, especially recently, we've had these big snowstorms. So like the snow version of hurricanes where you've got Snowmageddon, Snowpocalypse. Those haven't been around since the 1800s, or have they?
No, that's pretty new. Yeah, I started tracking some of those snow terms back in 2010. That's when I first noticed that people started using, those terms like Snowmageddon, Snowpocalypse was, you know, winter of 2010. And I found examples going back a few years before that, but that was when the language around snowstorms, at least here in the Northeast, seemed to get particularly apocalyptic. And so, yeah, that's a special kind of hyperbole that people like to use. Again, taking a word like Armageddon or apocalypse, taking off, you know, those syllables and then attaching it to something new, creating a new blend that way. And that's, you know, it's a fun way to create new words. But again, it's like, you know, if every big snowstorm is called Snowmageddon or Snowpocalypse, people will not necessarily take it so seriously, because it's not always like the end times when there's a big snowstorm.
Well, I mean, one of your colleagues, I don't know if you know him, and I'm not calling him out, Eric Holthaus, who suggested a term. This was back in 2012, Snoreastercane.
Snoreastercane. Yeah, well, that was if you remember Hurricane Sandy, when it hit the Northeast first, when it made landfall, it was actually no longer a hurricane, right? So it sort of got downgraded to a big tropical storm that they called a superstorm. So it was Superstorm Sandy when it hit the New York area, but then it combined in with this other weather system. A big snowstorm, an inland snowstorm. And so people started getting creative, and what are you going to call this new kind of hybrid thing that's, you know, part superstorm and part big snowstorm? And so Snoreastercane was one of the more creative examples that combined snow with nor'easter and hurricane into one big mess there.
It kind of reminds me of there were signs here in the city about 10 years ago telling everyone, you know, celebrate Chrismahana Kwanzaa.
Right, exactly.
That's what Snoreastercane makes me think of. But you
used a turducken or something.
Yes,
like that,
you used a phrase that actually a listener on Twitter wanted to know the origins of, and that is superstorm.
Yeah. We heard that particularly with Sandy. I'm sure that there were other big storms before that were called superstorms. But once it's technically no longer a hurricane, we saw the same thing, you know, happen, you know, just recently, Hurricane Irma. The wind speed slows down a bit, and so it goes from, you know, category 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and then it's no longer technically, according to the National Weather Service, a hurricane, and you just call it a storm or a tropical storm. But if you still want to get across, you want to convey the idea that this is a storm that can cause a lot of damage because of, storm surges and things like that, then superstorm is something that has been used just as a way to get across the magnitude of a storm that is not quite a hurricane.
Let's go to, I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought because superstorms have me a little weirded out. Bud, in Manhattan, your question for Ben.
Yeah, well, it's really neat that he's talking about snow now, because I've heard the term, it hit me within a whole nine yards, and I'm just wondering where that comes from.
That sounds like a mixed metaphor, and I don't even know anything about football. I just know that the whole nine yards is related to that.
Well, some people would say it's related to football. Other people say it's related to the amount of cement used in a cement mixer. Other people say it's the amount of ammo on an ammo belt.
Oh.
There are dozens and dozens of theories about where the whole nine yards come from. I don't know if the caller was suggesting it had something to do with 9 yards of snow, but it doesn't have a weather-related origin. This is actually one that etymologists have been puzzling over, and earlier examples have been found, and earlier than, for instance, World War II, so it doesn't have to do with ammo belts, for instance, or other things from that era. It seems to have originated as the whole 9 yards, or sometimes people said the whole 7 yards, but 9 yards seemed to win out in the end, just to refer to a whole litany of things, and so a long list, for instance. So I think that most likely it came from an image of perhaps like a piece of paper with a big list on it or something like that. But people love speculating about that one. I think more than any other phrase in English, people love coming up with their own etymological theories about where that one came from.
So we talked about how our compatriots in journalism like to hyphenate snow. Snowmageddon, Snowpocalypse, Snorreaster Cane, which I actually kind of like. It's fun. Another thing that we tend to do is to add Franken to things. Frankenstorm.
Yeah, that was another one that came up back in 2012 with Sandy when we had this kind of, again, like a hybrid storm system. And this one actually came from someone at the National Weather Service. And when they were trying to decide what to call it, there was this kind of playful suggestion. You might recall that Sandy hit right around Halloween. And so this idea of a Frankenstorm, because it was sort of, you imagine a Frankenstein's monster as being sort of stitched together from different things, was a term that was suggested as a kind of a ghoulish nickname for this storm system. And that caught on, but it was interesting to see the reaction to that at the time as people were sort of getting ready, hunkering down in advance of that storm system, was that a lot of the news outlets decided that they didn't want to use that term Frankenstorm because this was going to be a powerful and deadly storm, and it would trivialize the storm if you were using this kind of more playful name. And so a lot of news outlets, like the Washington Post, I believe, and CNN said, let's not use that term Frankenstorm. So it's another example of where people can be sort of very careful with their messaging. If they want to communicate that this is something serious, let's use serious language. Let's, stay away from these sort of more playful terms where, people might not appreciate exactly how deadly the weather can be.
Let's go to John on the Jersey Shore in New Jersey. John.
Yeah, another question about hurricane names. When do they retire hurricane names, and if they do that at all? And if so, what's the criteria? I'm asking because I'm a surfer. We follow these things. I mean, talk about amateur meteorologists. We follow them, and I remember surfing a Hurricane Bob in the early 90s, and then, I don't know, a decade later, there's another Hurricane Bob. And I said, how can there be another Hurricane Bob? We had, So
right.
Is there a criteria on that?
I don't know. The World Meteorological Organization, they're the ones in charge. I don't know if they have exact criteria for that. I think that the member states just kind of decide this one was serious. Obviously, ones like Harvey and Irma have to be retired. Big ones that make landfall in the U.S. and cause lots of damage, we're not going to use those again. I don't know if they have some sort of cutoff or whatever. It's funny because we only hear, about the big ones again, unless, maybe if you're a surfer, you hear ones that are sort of more out to sea and don't make landfall. And those are the names that get recycled, and it's just the big ones where they decide that name can't be used anymore.
One of the things you just said, what is it, the World
Meteorological WMO,
the WMO, they come up, they have these lists of six lists of names. But am I wrong, doesn't the Weather Channel have its own naming system?
Yeah, you know, the Weather Channel started doing that for winter storms just back in the winter of 2012-2013. They started doing this just on their own without kind of consulting with the National Weather Center or the World Meteorological Association.
They went rogue.
They did go rogue, yeah. And they decided that they were going to name winter storms in the same way. And the Weather Channel gave the same kind of rationale that, you know, the National Weather Center would give. This is important for communication. You know, we have a complex storm, it's easier to communicate if you give it a name. And so they started this naming program, you know, and there's been some criticism about it, again, because they're just the sort of private organization that's taken it upon themselves to come up with these names. And it seems to be, again, very much for kind of, you might say, branding, or at least so they can have a nice banner on the Weather Channel saying, you know, Tropical Storm Juno is on its way. But it's interesting, too, to see what they've done with it. After the first year they did it, there was a high school class in Bozeman, Montana, a Latin class. They noticed that the Weather Channel was using sort of classical names from Latin and Greek. And so they came up with their own names, and they ended up sort of partnering with the Weather Channel. And I believe they're still doing this Bozeman, Montana high school Latin class gets to come up with the list of names that they use, and they're all sort of classically derived names from either Latin or Greek. And so, you know, it cheers to the high school kids in Bozeman, Montana. But that's why, you know, we get, I'm just looking at the list of names from 2016, 2017. It started off with Argos, and, you know, it included, you know, Jupiter and Leo and Stella, Theseus, Ursa, and so forth. Hmm. We'll get a new list from the Weather Channel in October, I suppose. And, you know, and they seem like they do, unlike the hurricanes, I don't think they tend to reuse the name. So they have to sort of come up with new names every year.
So folks are listening. We've got two comments from listeners. One of them is something that I was thinking when it comes to Hurricane Sandy. This listener wanted to say, Sandy is androgynous. So, well. but the Hurricane Service, yeah. National Weather Service, slotted it in the feminine, yes, hurricane names.
That's correct, yeah. So they alternate between male and female names, and they picked Sandy as a female name. And actually, in that study that was looking at hurricane names and their impact and how people judge them as sort of masculine or feminine, despite the fact that Sandy is a name that could be used for men or women, apparently it's sort of judged as more feminine according to that study. It is odd, though, just to think, like, you know, why in the world are we even using these names? Why are we anthropomorphizing or personifying the storms, mm-hmm, with these given names? And, you know, in fact, the whole idea of giving women's names originally, before they started alternating with men's names, apparently goes back to World War II with forecasters in the Pacific during World War II giving storms, you know, typhoons out there in the Pacific names after their wives or girlfriends and so forth.
Wow, that's some kind of homage. Right. In the little time that we have left, refugee versus evacuees.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting one, too, because if you go back to Katrina 12 years ago, that was a very contentious point when people started being called refugees from Hurricane Katrina. There was a lot of pushback against that, really, on both sides of the political spectrum. So you had the Congressional Black Caucus and, you know, Jesse Jackson saying it was racist to call people who were forced out of their homes because of Katrina to call them refugees, because that implies somehow that they're not fully Americans. And so these days, you saw, like with Irma, that evacuee is much preferred as the term.
Yeah, and I remember back then at the time, it was don't call them refugees. Actually, the technical term is internally displaced people,
right,
which is a mouthful. Ben Zimmer. I've been speaking with Ben Zimmer, a Wall Street Journal language columnist. Thank you so much for joining us
today. Thank you. We'll be right back.